Blog Talk Radio.
Times when, for no apparent reason, a man just feels good about himself. Even as he looks out over the craziness that's happening around, there are those moments when things come together. The geometry seems to fit. There's a harmony. Purpose. Satisfaction. Hello. Welcome. You've found Masonic Effects. It's an absolute pleasure to have you joining us again today. And I've been hesitant to do that. I haven't done this for a little while. A shout out. This is to listeners. And these are fairly long-term listeners from Japan and Greece and the United States. Zambia, Russia, yes, and Britain. Hello, welcome, and thank you. I'm very grateful for the ongoing interest, and it's a litmus test in a way that what we're doing here has purpose and relevance for people, which is the point, to say something that makes some sense to a wide audience of Freemasons and free Masonically inclined thinkers. Yes, to you, I know you're there, and welcome. This station isn't an excuse and an apology. It's not a confection. It's reflections, starting conversations that I would love to enjoy with you. And one day I look forward to that, where we can sit and talk. And to be fair, it happens with more and more regularity around here, that somebody casually, obliquely, not too overtly ever, but obliquely catches my eye and wants to join in a conversation. And some are, you know, balled up their fists because, you know, I'm saying things heretical. Doesn't fit the mainstream. Well, I'll own that one. Because, you know, you begin to think about it like you do. We have this thing that we refer to as free will. And we have this ability, this curse, I would say, particularly here around North America, more so one part of North America than the other, but the influence is certainly there. You'll recognize it, to fit in, to want to suspend your own ideas, to be part of mainstream. Now, it gets confusing these days because of media access. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, men would dress in a suit and tie and hat to go to a football match. modesty, the bare suggestion of a unguarded ankle being shown at the bottom of a lady's skirts would be a cause célèbre. Scandalous. We've changed. Our values have changed for reasons that we can understand. If we want to be, you know, judgmental about it, well, good luck with that. Much more challenging, and I think rewarding, to begin an effort in understanding why these things have unfolded the way they have. Those moments because we can. It's like sitting back when things are very, very stressful and being able to laugh, just, you know, at the absurdity of what's going on. That's referred to as mental health, that capacity to do it. I'm not talking about the giggle fest. Everything is, you know, minimized, and it's that nervous chatter, you know, that happens. No. It's reflective. Now, what's excited me today? The commentary today is, I think, interesting. Yeah, victim of success. If we were all in possession of these qualities, and I took that, I extended that into an article that I wrote to support the promotion of this program about a parallel. And I became quite enamored, quite pleased with myself that I stumbled on to something that has been there for a very long time. And I say that because where I am, there is a great deal of effort invested in trying to refine the study of the value of masonry. To open the mind of men who are essentially closed-minded, and to the value of ethics and principles, and we're not talking about the Vitruvian man here. These fellows would generally have no idea why the Vitruvian man says something about the craft. They would have no idea. And you can see the sorting. We did what I suggested earlier, that idea of suspending the clarity of our thinking to the mainstream to fit in has been very, very powerful in the part of the world where I am. We do frown on certain practices, men trying to, but always our opinions change with the context. There are some men who we are taught would need to be a member of the craft in order to be successful in their particular job. We've had there's been exposés about that, scandals about nepotism, the like. Does it go on? I don't, in any kind of structured way, absolutely not. No, of course not. Does it happen with that your personal group of friends? Is there favors not received, but you don't encourage that with your friends? I would find that odd. Of course, to what extent? When we are acting with each other, we have some very, very interesting default positions. We do things to the extent that it's done in good taste, that it's done with a sensitivity to the people around us, to people that might not agree. Some of us naturally knew that. Had a sense of that being defensive was not a strong point of an order, a philosophically based, a values based order like Freemasonry. But even as I use these terms, you and I both know that it will elicit wrinkled faces. You know, it's not quite satisfying. It doesn't fit. And I think I want to illustrate that today, just a little bit. And we'll fill this in the next time that you and I sit down together and over a cup of where I am, it's morning right now. So a cup of cappuccino, please. It would be fine, and maybe a small roll, that would be, yeah, and a paper. And I'll wait for you, and roadside, it's lovely. Here, think about this. You and I are walking, all of us are walk into the Louvre, and we have that experience. Would we think that everybody should be equally affected and equally attracted? I think that would be lost. Maybe if we were herding tourists through and we got to do the Egyptian section, we got to do the Etruscan section, you know, get through and we give them our 7 minutes of stand time, or 12 minutes of stand time. And, oh, they got to do the Mona Lisa, you know, that kind of thing. Not to mock these sensitivities, but you get the point. Of course we wouldn't. And the more aware we were walking in, the more sensitive or thoughtful we were, we would not even think that there is one impression that we should come away with. It's the experience, the human experience. We aren't going to see all 490,000 pieces of the collection. No. We'll see a curated version by art experts. And we'll be exposed to fine art at its greatest. And I say that because we're walking through history as we're walking through imagination and creativity. But the building itself, the history of the building, the Louvre, the 12th century fortress, is enough for some. It stimulates curiosity for some. And thank you. I appreciate that. I want to sit and have you fill in these gaps in my understanding. And then shall we talk about the list of people who have lived in the building at one time, the kings or in some way the nobility, they're an interesting crowd. Yeah, where to begin? You just throw a dart into the pile or pick up a name and let's have at it. The work. And if you and I sat down and said, you know, let's talk about what the point is of the Louvre. I don't know. You first. Well, the point is exposure to the masterpiece, the masterpieces, you know, just to take it in, to see how good humanity can be, how controversial humanity can be, these showstoppers. Artists able to do things and express thought through their art, through their sculpture or their mimicry or their paintings that would have at different times meant a death sentence. But the arts are a different path of understanding. Do we become philosophical? I don't know how we don't. I don't know how we don't. When you're in that kind of environment, wouldn't you, I think, be missing the point? Like if we went to, I'm dragging you along, kicking and screaming, we're going to see La Boheme and René Fleming and Luciano Pavarotti, okay, in the day. And you're there for the very first time, and they have good seats, not too close, in the middle of the house, and it rises. So you're looking, I like it when you're looking at the stage, you know, sort of at the players. I like that because, and the room, more volume there. That's me. Would I be comfortable with you sitting beside me with a set of headphones on, listening to whatever? I don't think so. I don't think so. Now, why? Am I forcing the something on you? Come on. Really? That's all you've got? Or am I introducing? Is it tomato, tomato? No. You're forcing me to experiencing something. I might not like it. It's new. I won't like it. You're a terrible person for forcing me. You see the language of mediocrity. Huh? What happens when a person hasn't been encouraged, hasn't been supported? No, I wouldn't. This isn't about force. Far from it. I'd like you to hear. We'll experience this. At intermission, we'll go out and have a glass of champagne or two, depending on the performance in the house. And at the end, we'll go out for dinner and drinks and talk about the impressions. And that will be the most, in exchange for the tickets and your lovely company, would you think that's a reasonable contract between us? I don't think that makes the opera appeal to everybody. Would you take me by the arm to a performance of Shakespeare's The Tempest? I hope you would. And would you be fine if I sat there and read a good book? No. And how would I pick that up? I'd be looking around. The chatter, the energy. The audience is there not for one purpose, but for a purpose, to experience. Is there a geometry to that? You fractal geometrists, yes, you'll tell me that there is repeated patterns happening at a psychological level that with our drives, what drives people, but I don't think so. I think we have underestimated the enormity of Freemasonry. It was written by some incredible theorists and incredible minds, original thinkers. And then to help us to understand the antiquarians of Doug, incredibly gifted people have written about this. Now, is that to say that's the sum total? No, nobody is ever claiming that a historian captures the entire history of any event. But we can also say some history, if we're looking at Gibbon's work on the rise and fall of Rome, yeah, it's dated, it's valuable. It explains so much. Or Daniel Boorstin's work on the discoverers. Is that definitive? Of course not. Of course not. But it is a step. And it's there with another piece to be filled in eventually by another writer at another time from another perspective. We bring these perspectives with us. Imagine, here we have the greatest minds, and then the challenge is you'll understand their thinking, of course, and then you'll take that understanding into your life and govern yourself accordingly. Be influenced by it. Yes, simple. You give me such a simple task. Does that mean my dear grandfather, the old farmer, he was literate, and I think well read? He would read the King James Bible and Robbie Burns poems. Yeah, I know. And what that says about in the day, in that part of, on that island, what that says, curiosity. But to say that he wouldn't understand is entitlement, I think. Yeah. To say, it's work. And if I gain a small inkling of what is being taught, then I think I'm better off. Just that, I don't feel in any way that I'm in it's a competition. Although, you know, it feels that when somebody is, when you find somebody that's, this beautiful man I spoke to the other day, John, spent 20 years, I'm explaining my confusion with this enormously, the Kabbalah, okay, at that I'm confused, I'm not alone on the planet. But to hear somebody, he's charming, and I find him just very gifted, to say it's taken him 20 years, he's still confused. He still finds it challenging. Now, I consider him the foremost authority that I know of such a delicate topic, delicate material. We are on this, you and me, we're on the spectrums. But where I find it kind of curious, I think that odd that we're talking about the craft, what it is, not what it does, what it is. It's still, we're about 155, 160 years into that discussion, something there. And we still like to drag that up, to pull it out, as if there hasn't, all these other people before us didn't have that sensibility. There's something really quite magical, whether you understand the motivation of Picasso or of Van Gogh or Bellini or Caravaggio. Do you appreciate it? Well, hell, why? I'm trying to understand the Rococo and the Baroque and their fascination with pink. Well, it was the fascination with the rhinoceros and ostrich, their art. It's okay. We conduct ourselves. We dignify the study by the way we conduct ourselves. Oh, the frat parties can have their kegger and pass out on the front lawn on a Saturday night to the disgrace of one and all. We can put up hedges so we don't have to look at them. Or we can dry it out and talk about it. What in the world is going on? That's a pretty big question these days. What is it about the world and our communities that drive so many people to drugs and drug overdose? I'm not talking about sampling to experience the effects the way the poets once did and still do. I'm talking about an effort to escape reality. Hmm? Reality that has become, for whatever reason, so empty and people so resigned that they feel hopeless. What is it? Do the things that we capture, some of us find beautiful, does that make it a difference? Well, I think it does. I think it does. I think the music is soothing. The arts are soothing. Our camaraderie, done well, is a special experience. Now, would I open this to anybody? No. I would not do that. These are experiences that you get to. Some people do by happenstance, but you need to have that inkling, have that je ne sais quoi. There's something going on out of the corner of your eye, and you're curious about it. And beyond that, where it takes you and what motivates you to go to study something. I'm more interested in the fact that it does. And do we spend a lot of time navel gazing, trying to figure out what the motivation was, or do we focus our attention on the new findings? What's new today? What are you reading? What are you studying? Tell me your impressions. Opinions. Anything I say is the right thing. Yes, of course it is. But in our conversation, anything you say becomes something interesting and we want it to build. I will try to reciprocate. I will try to reflect on what you say. And as happens, as you become an old man, you begin to add trinkets, experiences, bits of information to build your credibility around your thoughts or your position. Keep that in mind. We're going to do the down the rabbit hole of Masonic effects again today. The poetry. I think it's an indulgence today. I was thinking about, September. I was thinking about, for whatever reasons and decent weather around me, I was thinking about wars past and current and influences. And from the horror to the psychopathy to the bittersweetness, what it says about mankind. I don't have that answer. I don't know if there is that answer. Rupert Brooke's poem. So we'll get into that in a moment. The commentary, you'll see. But would you mind? We'll just start this with a bit of jazz. The music, very much like masonry. Masonry shouldn't exist for all these hundreds of years. Are you kidding me? And neither should this music. Lovely. Just lovely. If we are all in possession of these qualities, it would explain what we have been calling indifference. No acclaim needed, no praise, no need for attention. We come from mystery, not dominance. Even then, we expect discretion. Ours is a world of hegemony, not in any political mansion, but of an assurance that some men somewhere are keeping an ethical course in mind, doing what is right, because it is the right thing to do. Is it even possible to measure organizational goals with such a group? Is it not written that we need illustrate to our betters what we have done and what we will do? Again, and how? How can we measure effectiveness? What question to ask? Stoics in the crowd have shunned this attention. They may understand it, but not trust efforts to draw attention to their actions, while at the same time they're happy to evaluate, in hindsight, the accomplishments of long-lost brethren. Tell me, is there a more difficult task? With enough knowledge to know what we don't know, we know we will never be able to measure success in this group. Tossing out the occasional celebrity name holds little of any meaning for them. Even as a guide, masonry fits the thinking and lifestyle of Stoics like a glove in a hand. Self-reliant, independent, practical, high standards, level-headedness, minimalism. Emotional control. I'd say we might want to find a more accurate tool to measure this crowd, but don't expect that they can co-opt their inspired beliefs for a mission statement or a strategy. We aren't speaking their language. And I love that they speak masonry. Brilliant. That'll have to do. Scott Hamilton. The poem, Poetry Corner. Today I'm tipping into something that is more of an indulgence than I usually like to admit. For those of you out there who may be learning a different appreciation for what poetry does for a man, for a person. Excuse me, I'm having a struggle at my age. I have difficulty thinking in gender terms about these ideas. And I know masonry, where I am, is practiced as an order of men. I also have spoken to women nearby who have an order of women, masons, and are not keen to, in any way, to muddy the waters, so to speak. The poem, the poet today is Rupert Brooke. He was an interesting man. I came across him, I don't begin to know. Oh, well, I do a search for appropriate poetry that fits with the motifs of Masonic effects. Rupert Murdoch, he was born in August 3rd, 1887 in Warwickshire, England. And he died in 1915, 23rd of April in Greece. Now, the reason that I have picked up an interest has to do with his work on wartime sonnets that he put out in 1914, just before he died. And it brought him immediate fame. Now, the first three lines of this poem are over the archway at the military academy here in Canada. That's not the only place that they're used. Here we're going to tip into a poem known, referred to as The Dead, of all things. You know. He wrote five poems that were published in 1914. And this is under the collection of The Soldier. And The Dead was the fourth part. These were sonnets, and one of his favorites, and one of mine as well. The five poems, you can see, Peace, Safety, The Dead, again, he did two parts of that, and The Soldier. So today we're going to look at The Dead. Mm-hmm. Now, why is this significant? The Dead is a discussion of the soldiers who died for their nation. These were, at the time, these were not, you know, relics of the past. These were the guy down the street, the uncle that taught us how to ride a bicycle, the farm kid that was pretty good with a rifle shooting varmints, and fighting where I am, fighting for an idea, something that they believed in, and being damn good at it, as a matter of fact, very brave. But when we talk about bravery with men and women that go to face imminent death and risk, it is a level of respect. If only the insouciance of our immature minds could make it all go away. In this first stanza, he talks about their life and how their hearts were made with joy. They had sorrows and difficulties, yet they were brave enough to just laugh them off. I like that part. He provides a vibrant imagery through weather and sunset and music and flowers. You know, when nobody's looking and you see this flower and it's like, ha, one of those moments. And then as a contrast to the first, in the second stanza, he talks about the death of these guys, these people. That though they died, they brought honor. And they made the deepest possible sacrifice. So how could we possibly doubt or question the authenticity of this. If you're looking, it's an interesting period of history. Drinkwater, Monroe, Gibson, you know, there's Edward Marsh, Brooke, there's Georgian poetry, yeah. Here. Blow out, you bugles, over the rich dead. There's none of those so lonely and poor of old but dying has made us rarer gifts than gold. These laid the world away, poured out the red, sweet wine of youth, gave up the years to be of work and joy, and that unhoped serene that men call age, and those who would have been, their sons, they gave their immortality. Bugles, blow bugles. They brought us for our dearth, holiness, lacked so long, and love and pain. Honor has come back as a king to earth and paid his subjects with a royal wage. And nobleness walks in our ways again, and we have come into our heritage. The second version of that. For the dead. These hearts were woven of human joys and cares, washed marvelously with sorrow, swift to mirth. The years had given them kindness. Dawn was theirs, and sunset, and the colors of the earth. These had seen movement and heard music, known slumber and waking, loved, and God proudly befriended, felt the quick stir of wonder, and sat alone, and touched flowers and furs and cheeks. All this is ended. There are waters blown by changing winds to laughter and lit by the rich skies all day. And after frost with a gesture stays the waves that dance in wandering loveliness, he leaves a white unbroken glory. The gathered radiance, the width, the shining peace under the night. I know it's not something we walk around thinking every day, but to honor people like that, that's, I think, a reasonable thing to keep in mind. The honor. This happens when men like us aren't defined by the politics, by the mainstream. We are the influence. We are the connection. It's not a gig we asked for. This comes with the territory. Benny Golson. I don't know if everybody's familiar with that, his work. Our history portion has been talking about influences in Dutch Freemasonry, the influence of the British Freemasonry. And it comes from a period when they were both major trading centers and had a lengthy history of trade, hubs, civilization. Still even today, when we think of the arts and music, those areas, those countries often are top of the list. Everything wasn't rosy. Everything wasn't just pleasant and easy. It wasn't a laugh fest. It wasn't something of a cheerleader's dream. These were serious times, serious matters, as they are today, even though often they're trivialized, made to feel like they're popular and mainstream. Living these virtues sets us apart. And people react to that. Who the hell do you think you are? Here. Around the time that we're talking about now, the late 1770s, there was more of a deepening economic crisis in the Republic, quarreling with Britain because of Dutch trade with the American colonies. And the impending Anglo-Dutch War. And this was the moment when Dutch reformers began to sense that something had gone very wrong and to question the competence of the stadtholder and his government. Within a few months, the orator will praise the brothers for being Dutch and freedom-loving. The themes of light and enlightenment are renewed in these discourses. The master is compared to the glowing light in the West. Once again, the lodge disputes with the Grand Lodge, this time about La Bien Amie's reluctance to send representatives to an international meeting in Frankfurt to consult about the interests and concerns of the order. Prussia, incidentally, was a British ally. Finally, by the end of the year, the order tells his brothers of their love for our dear fatherland in a time when proud and useless lust for power as well as an abominable egoism intend its downfall. History repeating itself, eh? The love we received by drinking the milk of childhood showed itself in full force. That is our affection for the distinguished government of the country, as well as for a dutiful subjugation to its administration. Its cautious and wise decrees present sound evidence that real Freemasons are good friends and loyal patriots. They are loyalist sentiments expressed in wartime. They are best interpreted as still vaguely orangist. Yet there is a concession intended by the reference to patriotism. It would seem that there are reformers also present in this lodge. What is also clear is that the lodge is in debt. These were economically very troubled times, and the lodge is having trouble raising its monthly and annual dues. What is needed, the master says, is a contract from each brother. The lodge, although increasingly concerned for its survival, is not preoccupied to the exclusion of the world around it. Yet for economic reasons, the number of visitors from Amsterdam must be limited to any one meeting. These troubles could have been seen as analogous to those of the larger society. The pillars of a small society consist of observing good order, maintaining the constitution, and a reasonable freedom. Following these pillars results in the growth of that society. while neglect inevitably causes downfall or decay. Decline can occur in any society. That is the message to be drawn from the remarks of the Master. In the same year, the orator explains that work produces unity in the lodges, but is work enough? We were so close to getting an answer there. So close. Is work enough? We'll have to tune in next week and find out how to answer that. Here, Cedar Walton Trio. It's called Skylark. Beautiful. David Williams, Billy Higgins sits in with them. That seems to be where we are at the end of the program for this week. It was good. We did make connections. If you're at all confused, and perhaps my stumblings about culture and comparisons will be of some use. I find it very helpful, but then again, you know, when I'm listening to tales from travelers, some glory in being where others have gone before, some in the moments of luxury, some as if the person with the most travel experience wins. Yeah, I know. Me. Who did they see that was different? What was different about the culture and the expression of aspiration of the people around? Tell me about the solitude. Tell me about the stars. The music. The camaraderie. The culture. Next week, we'll make every attempt to pick this conversation up. I'm chuffed. I'm so encouraged that you join us, that you pull up your comfortable chair and your favorite beverage and sit back for a short period of time and reflect. Be sure to commit many acts of random Masonic kindness and include yourself in that. You deserve it. I'll see you again soon.